Stories are an interesting thing to me. And one of the things I love about the book of Acts, it's a story. The stories in Acts. You know, we read stories and we think we get them. Notice the title of this message is The Story Behind the Story. There's always more going on. And there's, you start paying attention and it connects backwards, it seems. And the author's doing things that we just can't even imagine at times. And all of a sudden it just jumps off the page. You know, we experience that kind of thing with people. You run into somebody, you get start getting to know them, and you know, they're kind of porcupine prickly. And they don't allow you very close. And you get kind of annoyed, and you start judging them for their behavior. And yet, all of a sudden, you learn things behind the story. Maybe it was adolescent abuse. And so they're protecting themselves from hurt and pain and sorrow. More of it. We read stories like the Chronicles of Narnia, some of my favorite stories. And there's so much there. You know, there's the lion, and there's the Narnia itself, the creation of this world, and there's the sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve, and there's animals that are half human and half animal, and they talk, and there's war that stains the land with blood. There's a mouse that's a hero. But Lewis was doing so much more there. I mean, his favorite psalm was Psalm 19. You know, the heavens declare the glory of God and the sky proclaims the work of his hands. And see, there's seven books, and for years, for 50 years, people were saying, what's the connection? And it just seems there's disconnected, and people didn't know how they fit together. And it's been discovered that Lewis was a medieval scholar. And there are seven books in the series. And in the medieval worldview, this isn't accurate, but there were seven planets in the medieval worldview, and there were seven heavens. Seven books, seven planets, seven heavens. And two of those planets were the sun and the moon in the medieval worldview, the way they saw the world. But the interesting thing is each planet has a mood or a characteristic in that worldview. And that mood and characteristic influences the world. And each novel in the series has a different planet that permeates the story with its personality. I find that fascinating. It is hidden. That planet is hidden throughout, but it's constantly present. And when you know what to look for, it's just all over the place. The transcendent invades the local, and it influences. And you thought they were just nursery books, but they aren't. He's doing so much more. There's layers. There's always a story behind the story. In our lives, my life, in your lives, our neighbors' lives, and even in the Bible, it just keeps on going deeper and deeper, the well. In our text this morning, we have the story of Peter. Peter's the main character. He's been more prominent at the beginning of Acts. First 12 chapters, it's more about Peter, and Paul's in there a little bit, and Philip's in there a little bit. But even Peter shows up with Philip, making sure that what's going on with these Samaritans? They're all coming to faith. How can that be? So he and John go check it out. But we have the story of Peter. Peter shows up, and he's right here all of a sudden after we have the whole story of Paul and being let down and saved from people trying to kill him and the Damascus Road experience. And Luke just kind of jumps right back to Peter. It's kind of an abrupt switch. Well, Peter, the apostle, was able to take a breather. The persecution had stopped. There's historical reasons for that. But there was a time of peace, it says. Peter plays this prominent role in the church. The Catholics are persuaded that Peter was the first pope. His humanness exudes as we follow his story throughout the Bible. This is what I love about Peter. He made a living throwing nets as a fisherman in the fishing village of Bethsaida. We know he was married. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all tell us that in Capernaum, Jesus healed his mother-in-law. Peter's probably Jesus' most challenging and frustrating follower. I love that about him. He loved the sea. Peter loved the sea. But we know the sea is unpredictable, like Peter. The sea is up and down with waves, like Peter. Peter's personality is a sea personality. He's impulsive. Peter was the first to tell Jesus in front of his friends that he was the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God, but he wasn't clear what that meant. He was very unclear. Jesus set him straight and said, Peter, you're Satan right now. Get behind me. You're trying to persuade me not to go to the cross. And when Jesus spoke clearly that his disciples would shamefully abandon him, Peter adamantly and arrogantly said, that will never happen. And then the rooster crowed. And Peter realized, I said three times, I don't know the guy. And when Jesus rose from the dead, the women ran to tell the men about the resurrection, and we're told that Peter hightailed it with the beloved, John, to the tomb. And they get there, and it says that John saw the linen, John saw and he believed. And Peter looked in and he saw the linen and the head dress, and it was all neatly folded. But Peter, Luke tells us, went away wondering to himself what happened. He didn't get it. We read and hear the name Peter, and we should be encouraged. You should be encouraged. I should be encouraged. Because Peter gets it, but he doesn't get it. Peter confesses belief, and he denies any affiliation with Jesus. Peter speaks without reflection and commits without counting the cost. Sounds a lot like what we go through in our lives. Peter embarrasses himself time and again in front of his friends. He gives room for people like us to feel safe in the presence of Jesus. That's what I love about Peter. We aren't called to be perfect. We are called to live in the grace of God in Jesus Christ. This gospel that we preach is not about our performance. It's not about how good we are. It's not about us keeping rules. It's not about our getting A's on a report card for Jesus. If Jesus can take a turbulent fisherman formed up and down by the movements of the waves and use him to turn the world upside down, he can use the likes of us or the likes of a Sarah Smith. A Sarah Smith. Who's Sarah Smith? We've all known a Sarah Smith. When my dad died, it was within the first 6 months, we had gone to visit my grandma Gray, my mom's mom, and there was my sister, and we were driving, and it was pouring rain. It was one of those humid days and in Michigan, and it just was dumping, and we had a blowout, and my mom had never changed a tire, and we were really young, and we hadn't, and so my mom sat there and cried. And then she said, well, we just have to pray. And so we prayed. She prayed, and we sat there. And about 10 or 15 minutes later, this car pulls up behind us, and out get these two guys, just normal-looking guys. And, you know, here my mom's feeling a little apprehensive, you know. And they come, they ask what's going on. They had seen the blowout, and they were driving down the freeway, and at the very same time they said, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And they said, the one guy said, yeah, we need to turn around. God wants us to go back. And these were Christ followers. And so they circled around and they came back and they changed our tires. This is their Sarah Smith. Another Sarah Smith for me was Dad Carrico sitting in his underwear, smoking a brown cigarette at the kitchen table. I was 10, and it was after my dad died, and in between drags on that cancer stick, because he did die of lung cancer, he would take a drag, and he'd say something, and they'd blow the smoke up in the air, and He looked at me and he said, "Mark, you aren't welcome in my home anymore." And then he paused and he took another drag and the smoke filled the room. He said, "Unless two things change, you're never to knock on my door again. You just come in." And then he said, "And no more calling me Mr. Carrico anymore. It's just Dad from now on." I mean, I could go on. So could you. We've all had Sarah Smith people in our lives. And here's the thing about those kinds of people. They're common, flawed people used by God in ginormous ways. Sarah Smith people. You see, Sarah Smith was a literary figure in The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis that the high school kids just read. The narrator sees her coming from the land of light, from heaven. And he thinks she must be some queen, some ancient person, this prominence, something royal. And he only partly remembers, and I love this expression, the unbearable beauty of her face. The unbearable beauty of her face. And she walked with countless boys hanging on one hand and countless girls on the other hand. And the angels surrounded her, the whole scene, and the music filled the air with beautiful tunes. And flower petals were tossed to cover the ground beneath her feet as she walked, kind of like palm branches on the Sunday before crucifixion. And the narrator is told, you know, she's someone you have never heard of. I love that. Her name on earth is Sarah Smith, and she lived at Golders Green. A common name, Sarah Smith, a place no one knows about, Golders Green. I mean, he could have said she lived in a 30-year-old leaky single wild 10 miles south of Ephrata. And then the narrator's heavenly guide continued. She's one of the great ones, though. You have heard that fame in this country and fame on earth are two quite different things. Sarah Smith, normal, common people like us. So who's your Sarah Smith this morning? You are a Sarah Smith too. Don't underestimate the work of your hands. And then there's the story of Jesus. It seems so obvious what we're to pay attention to Jesus. I mean, he's the reason why we gather. Peter says to Ananias in our text, "Jesus Christ heals you." We may become disillusioned with the church. We may become disillusioned with the hypocrisy of others. And we would do well to become a little bit disillusioned with our own double-mindedness. But we are to quote the Bible, fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. It's that simple. Charles Templeton was Billy Graham's right-hand man and pulpit partner. They worked together for years at the beginning, but Billy Graham, Templeton argued, had this inability to express the faith in a robust, thoughtful way that was needed in our more modern culture. And that was unacceptable to him. He wasn't satisfied. And he would say Graham was just too simplistic. So eventually, Templeton abandoned the faith, became an agnostic, and passionately opposed the faith. It reminds me of the story of two Jewish inmates. They were standing together in Auschwitz, and the chimneys were going, and the smoke filled with ashes was going up to heaven like they were prayers, and the crematorium was right there, and there was just the silence. They stood there together for quite some time, and then one of the men broke the silence, and he said, "Well, I suppose all this must have been God's will." The other man confessed that sentence in that moment turned him into an atheist. I like what Joe Marcus says. He says, "Nothing can induce despair more quickly than a premature, ill-thought-out affirmation of faith." There needs to be some depth, and that's what Templeton was after. And I'm not so sure that was Billy Graham's role, but he didn't get that from his friend. Yet he held that till the day he died, but he never spoke poorly of Graham, even within the last month of his life. He said, "Billy is just pure gold. There's no feigning or fakery in him. He's a first-rate human being, and he's profoundly Christian." And yet he couldn't shake his perspective of needing more. Yet, right before his death, this is what he said. "Jesus was the greatest human being who has ever lived. He was a moral genius. His ethical sense was just unique. He was the intrinsically wisest person that I've ever encountered in my life or read. I know it may sound strange, but I have to say, I adore him. He is the most important human being that has ever existed. And if I may put it this way, I miss him." In all the struggles Peter wrestled with in his life, he kept coming back to Jesus. And we see it hidden underneath the story. And so must we. Two miracles, Annas and Dorcas, flow out of the life of Jesus. Peter has been reflecting on his past. I mean, he's hung personally with Jesus. He's been formed in the Jesus way. He remembers Jesus' moves and words, and what caused Jesus joy and what ticked Jesus off. Jesus had healed Peter's mother-in-law in Capernaum. And shortly after that, Jesus finds himself in that home, jammed elbow to elbow with people. Friends of a lame guy, we know the story. We read it this morning. They carry him to Jesus so that he can heal them, him, but the crowd just blocks their path. So they climb up on the roof, they cut a hole in the roof, and they lower him right down in front of Jesus. And Jesus heals him. He heals him based on his own authority. First, he forgives his sins. Your sins are forgiven. It's one of those remarkable statements. It would be like Dave and Sarah having an argument in their marriage, and Dave's definitely in the wrong, which is always the case, and me's talking with him and say, I just say, "Dave, you're forgiven for your sin towards Sarah." And she's like, "Wait a minute, you can't do that. She's sinned towards me. You know, that's my to give away." Yeah, but Jesus forgives. And then he says, "Get up, take your mat, and go home." He does this on the authority of his person. Peter heals Annas, and he says, "Jesus heals you." He does it on the authority of Jesus. "Get up and take your mat," he says. Peter lives out Jesus' healing, the man being lowered through the roof. He's internalized the ways of Jesus, Peter has. His words prove this close connection to Jesus. He takes no credit. Jesus heals you. But he's saying the same kinds of things that Jesus did and said. And then you think of Peter raising Dorcas from the dead. Peter's 12 miles away. 12 miles away. That's up Beasley Hill, down Beasley Hill, up Beasley Hill, and back down. So for them to go get Peter, because they have to go get him, they have to do that, find Peter, and then do it all again to get back to where Dorcas is. The church chases down Peter, and they want him to hurry back. I mean, this is a lot of dead time for Dorcas. There's a pun there, and I meant it to happen. I mean, I know my experiences with death and dying are unique. I know that. I have met people 70 plus years old that have never seen a dead body, or a couple, maybe. But it is very common for people not to have those experiences. I mean, very few have handled death. I mean, regularly for years, I would clean the dead. I would take off their clothes and then clothe them in what the family wants when they leave the house. I would stay with them and be with family while they waited for more family to come so we could gather and have a time of prayer. I waited for morticians to arrive. Dorcas's body was washed and moved to an upstairs room. Understand, this culture handled death all the time. This is just part of their way of life. They took care of things. They understood when a person was dead. There wasn't any guessing. Not mostly dead as in The Princess Bride. I mean dead, dead. In Mark 5, a leader of the synagogue named Jairus pleaded with Jesus to come and heal his dying daughter. But Jesus is too late. While en route, Jairus was found by friends and told his daughter had died and they just needed to let Jesus be. Leave him alone. He's not needed now. But Jesus continues to the house, and Jesus took only Peter, James, and John with him. Here's Peter, and he's taking it all in. He's being formed by Jesus because he's hanging with him. And Jesus was sneaking in all of this. He's sneaking his way of thinking and speaking and being into Peter, into James, into John. Jesus puts out all the people so he can deal just with this dead girl. And it's exactly what Peter does. He comes to the house and he clears everybody out so he can be alone. There's no hint of sensationalism. None. And Peter would have spoken in Aramaic on this occasion. And that means that there was only a single letter, one letter that separated exactly what Jesus said and what Peter would have said. Jesus said, "Talitha cum," which means little girl, get up. Talitha. Peter said, "Tabitha cum." One letter separated it. Dorcas's Hebrew's name was Tabitha. And what happened? Resurrection. Because our God is a God of resurrection. He's giving dead people life. We can struggle with stories like this. Let's just be honest. We are modern scientific people. It doesn't fit our framework. Yet our Bible are filled with miracle accounts, just Mark's gospel, all the way up until you get to the Passion when Jesus starts this journey right into Jerusalem to the cross. Half of that material are miracles and exorcisms. The book of Acts that we're studying, a fifth of it deals with stories of miracles. Our Western denial of miracles, it reaches back to David Hume, who died in 1776, when our country was born. Hume was interesting. You know, he was really influenced by radical deists like Thomas Jefferson, who had problems with miracles. So what does Jefferson do? He writes his own Bible. He cuts out all the miracles because he thought they were just ludicrous. So there was the Jefferson Bible. Hume said that there were no credible eyewitnesses for miracles. Anyone who claimed to be an eyewitness doesn't count because we know miracles don't happen. That was his logic. People are either deceivers or deceived when it comes to miracles. But this morning, miracles are in our texts. And why are they there? Because the story behind the story of Jesus who died and was raised from the dead, is right there. This is the center of which all our way of seeing the Word flows out, this center of resurrection. The paralyzed Annas walks. The Zertot, the very dead Dorcas, lives. Basil Pascal, he's called the father of modern computer. And he had a niece that had a terrible eye disease, and it just oozed this foul odor and color, and she couldn't see. And the niece was instantly and publicly healed as an act of faith. And this was such a public event that the Queen Mother of France sent her personal physician to investigate the claim, and it was verified medically. I mean, it happened. They checked it out with witnesses. And so how did David Hume respond to this event? Well, he said that this eyewitness miracle has far better evidence for its validity than even the miracles we have in the Bible. But we know that that could not have happened, so why would we believe the miracles in the Bible? A little circular. We believe because we work out of the center. And the question is, what happened at sunrise the first Easter morning? That's the big question. What was it about that day that changed fearful, uneducated fishermen like Peter into fearless witnesses for Jesus? Could it really be the resurrection? How dare these fishermen think that they can even unleash women to preach the good news and lead in ways that prior to Jesus it was just forbidden? Jesus did unleash the women as the first preachers and witnesses to the resurrection. I mean, did you notice that there is very little detail in our story given to Aeneas? Well, there's no interest in him. He's not called a disciple. The story's short. It's even curt compared to Dorcas. She's prominent in the community. She's a business leader. She's a businesswoman. She lives in a home with an upper room. There's wealth. Many think that's where the church was meeting, and she was a prominent leader in the church. Those mourning her death were clothed in the clothes that she made. The Greek tells us that. She's called a disciple. We get a long obituary compared to the disinterest in the guy who just told to take up his mat and go home. Luke constantly does this. He highlights women more and makes them more prominent than he does men. David Keener is a scholar. And there's a sense where you have to understand when I tell you where they've gone and where they've been educated, there's plausibility to that. We're not talking about some fly-in-the-night TV evangelist who's kind of cray-cray. His PhD is from Duke. He has done extensive research and work on issues of miracles. He's produced a 1,200-page work of world research. And you would quickly learn that Keener is a world Christian. His wife is a native to the Congo in Central Africa. Chapter 12 of his book is titled Blindness, Inability to Walk, Death, and Nature. I read 60 pages of that this week, not the whole thing, of that chapter, because inability to walk and death describe Aeneas and Dorcas pretty well. And so in the section called Healing of Those Unable to Walk, he documented earlier reports, contemporary reports of healing in Africa and Asia, contemporary reports of healings in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, listed after and after with a story, documented, interviews, quotes, medical substantiation. And then, in the section, Raising the Dead, he documents biblical and non-Christian accounts, it was very fascinating, alternative explanations, ? And then earlier accounts, raising accounts in Africa, raising of my wife's sister, Mama Gina's account, other accounts from the Congo, raising accounts in Asia, raising accounts in the Philippines, raising accounts in Latin America and the West, reports from physicians. Keener had a friend of 20 years. His name was Leo Bawa of Nigeria. And Leo shared the story of when he was in northern Nigeria. His host's neighbors came to the house. They heard he was there. And they handed him their dead child. And this is what Leo Bawa recounts. He said, initially, I was confused and perplexed, but eventually summoned up enough courage by faith, I guess, that all things are possible through God. So I took the dead body into the room while the people waited outside. Here's a man's mind saturated with the gospel. He did exactly what Peter did. He did exactly what Jesus did. In the room, I prayed and I pleaded with God, restore this little boy's life. A few hours later, he opened his eyes and coughed. With him fully restored, I came out of the room and handed over the boy to his parents alive. The parents were wailing and weeping after witnessing the miracle of God, were filled with joy. Many people who were skeptics and hitherto suspect of me and my work were filled with awe and gave praise to God. Just this matter-of-fact account. I mean, sometimes I can honestly say, I don't know what to do with that. And yet, we gather because we confess that Jesus Christ rose from the dead on the third day. And he appeared to the witnesses. And they've seen him. And that revolutionized the world. You cannot get a church without the resurrection. Our passage ends with, immediately Annas got up. All who lived in Lydia and Sharon saw him and turned to the Lord. Dorcas, coming back to life, became known all over Joppa, and many people believed in the Lord. I mean, should these kinds of stories here surprise us as people who believe and confess on the third day Jesus rose from the dead? That is the gospel. In the name of the Father, and in the name of the Son, and in the name of the Holy Spirit.